that's some thoughts. Maybe there's a little bit of time for questions. I don't know if there's answers, but at least questions.
Have you met the Dalai Lama in person?
Yes, I have.
What was it like the first time?
I'm trying to think, the first time I had an interview with him, it was way back. I don't know, maybe early 80s or something. It was way before he was so famous. And I went in and I asked him some questions about karma and how karma and the universe relate, you know, how karma influences physical events and how karma ripens, and questions like this. And His Holiness was very kind, because the person who was translating at that time, I think, didn't have the vocabulary necessary to answer my question, because I remember him saying, oh, please go call, you know, this one monk from the dialectic school and tell him to come here and translate, you know? And it was very touching, because it was like he really wanted to be able to answer my question and take that time to do that. Yeah.
I just want to make a comment on, especially the question, but a comment on about how we are often suspicious. I love that. And the movie Sicko has just come out, Michael Moore, and people are saying it's about healthcare. But I think it's about more than that. And one of the, he goes to England and France and other countries about their healthcare. One of the things that comes out is that people don't have as much of that. I mean, well, of course, we're just helping people. Everyone has a right to this. And then he juxtaposes it with kind of the U.S. Well, if we do this, we will find ways where people cannot cheat. And this somehow part of that mindset is deeply embedded in our, you know, for our country, our particular cultural thing. Just like saving the world, but also that kind of the suspicion that we have of people, something that made me realize, oh, that's not just me, that's a whole national mindset. It's a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah. Of being suspicious that other people are going to cheat us.
Take advantage of
us. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's an interesting thing to ask ourselves, what is my definition of being taken advantage of. Yeah? I mean, sit with that. Do a little bit of meditation on that sometime. You know, what is my definition of people taking advantage of me? What does that look like? Yeah. And why do I call that being taken advantage of, but another situation I don't call it being taken advantage of? Yeah. What are my criteria? Where do I give that label? And then watching how, as soon as we give that label, then whoom, this whole suspicion, resentment, defensiveness comes in. Yeah. How one label, yeah, they're taking advantage of me, you know? Yeah. I wash the dishes for my housemate. Oh, they're taking advantage of me because they left the dirty dishes in the kitchen, knowing that I can't stand it and that I'd break down and wash it for them. You know? So here I am, and they know me so well because I can't stand a dirty kitchen, and I'm washing their dishes, and I'm so angry at them. And they're taking advantage of me. Okay. And to ask ourselves, why do I label that somebody taking advantage of me? Okay. First of all, how do I know that they had that motivation? Yeah. Because we don't. We have no idea, you know. We need to go to them and say, did you leave the dirty dishes in there knowing that I would clean it up because I can't stay in the dirty kitchen? Until we ask them that question and get their answer, we really don't know if that was their motivation. Okay, so first of all, why are we projecting that motivation on without having checked it out? Then second thing, even if they were doing it for that motivation, why do I have to feel like I'm being taken advantage of? Yeah? Is taking advantage something somebody else does to me? Or is it something that I decide I'm going to label on the situation and then feel that I'm being taken advantage of? Okay. Why don't I label that an opportunity to do something kind for somebody?
It doesn't feel as good.
It doesn't feel as good? So you're saying that we feel better when we're angry because somebody's taking advantage of us.
The selfish feeling just gives us, it's hard to give and it's so easy to take.
Yeah. And this thing, and what you're saying, I think is very true. We get a lot of mileage out of getting angry. Yeah? Because it makes it feel like I exist. There's this big I when we're angry. And yet, we're so miserable. They're taking advantage of me. Who do they think they are? Leaving their cup in the sink day after day. And we get this adrenaline rush and the blood starts pumping. And, we get this rush. But are we happy?
No, it feels awful.
It feels awful. It feels totally awful. Yeah. And yet, we can't bring ourselves to say, I'm doing something nice by washing their cup. Because we might actually feel good about ourselves if we were doing something nice. Wouldn't we feel a lot happier if we could do something nice for somebody else and feel good about ourselves doing that? Yeah? But it's weird how we choose a thing that's going to make us more unhappy because it gives us more of this kind of stress rush kind of feeling of being important. The function of the self-grasping ignorance. Yeah.
This question of being taken advantage of, that's sort of when you turn it inward, it feels like taking advantage of me. But there is something you need to watch out for looking at the actual effects. Mm-hmm. Am I enabling irresponsibility?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, there is that component in it as of am I enabling, irresponsibility. So you have to watch out for that because that's when you get into the people-pleasing, But we have to really ask ourselves, are we doing that or are we using that as an excuse to, to get this rush from being angry? Because the thing is that we should be able to make that decision without getting angry at all. Just see the situation, Is it a situation where this person needs some more responsibility, in which case, I have to give them that responsibility. And, I am not beyond at the Abbey. I mean, when people leave their stuff around and don't clean up, they find it in unusual places. Yeah? And I guess, it's not done with a harmful intent or with anger or anything like that, but it's just, okay, this doesn't belong here, let's put it somewhere else.
Does that get you faster to enlightenment?
I think the thing is, looking at the mind that's doing it. That's the thing, yeah?
But maybe part of the fear of being taken advantage of is so hard to recognize the difference.
Hard
to recognize when you're enabled.
Yeah, okay. So you're saying that the difficulty we have is we can't draw the line between enabling and being taken advantage of.
Yeah, it's so hard to recognize. I think just personally.
Yeah.
A lot of times I'm afraid, is what I'm doing really a good thing?
Yeah.
Or am I simply a trigger with students? Am I just letting them get by with stuff?
Right, right.
I shouldn't be letting them get by with.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's a thing of looking and really thinking, okay, kind of where's this person at, and what level of responsibility are they able to bear, and giving them that level of responsibility, not less and not more. And that's a difficult skill to have, to know when to sense how to do that. But I think, you know, especially like, you know, you're a teacher, then it's one of the things I think teachers have to do is teach people how to be responsible. So you have to help them and nudge them and encourage them, but you have to, you know, give them the opportunity to do it. And you have to give them the opportunity to fall flat on their face. Yeah? Because sometimes that's how people best learn. You know?
This is a question that I've heard the Dalai Lama, not heard, but read the Dalai Lama discuss.
Uh-huh.
But it's very confusing, and it's the idea of egolessness, the absence of ego, or the illusion of ego.
Right.
And of course, in the West, you know, we value the ego. We talk about having strong self-esteem, and sort of the whole goal of, you know, our lives is to develop, you know, a strong, integrated personality and all that. And that's just very totally different from what I think I understand the holiness.
Okay, so when his holiness is talking about egolessness or selflessness, and how does this fit in with the Western thing of having a strong ego and strong self-esteem and so on and so forth? Actually, I think the less we grasp onto ourselves in a self-centered way, the more we have good self-esteem. Okay? The more we grasp onto ourselves and make a big deal about ourselves, the lower self-esteem we have. Because you see, whenever we make a big deal about ourselves, you know, the way the ego mind works is we start comparing ourselves to everybody else, and what happens? I'm less than. Okay? When we aren't making such a big deal about ourselves because we aren't paying attention to ourselves in an unhealthy way, but instead we're cultivating an attitude of compassion for others, then there's the opportunity for self-esteem to arise. Because we see that we are one sentient being, so we are important because we're one sentient being, but we are also unimportant because we're one sentient being. Okay? So we learn to have some kind of, because you see, to practice the path, you need self-esteem. But I think what we mean in America by self-esteem isn't necessarily actually self-esteem. Okay? Because we think of self-esteem as being, I can do this, I'm the best, I'm talented, nobody's going to get me down. That attitude is a setup for failure. Yeah? Because that attitude is consistently placing ourselves in relationship to other people. As soon as we compare ourselves to other people, you know, we're always going to be in trouble. We're never going to be as good as we think we should be. Whereas if we learn to respect other people's good qualities and also see their weaknesses and be able to look at ourselves and see our own good qualities without getting arrogant about them, because we also know that we have weaknesses, then, you know, there's a sense of self that's necessary to practice the path. But it's not this self-centered kind of sense of self.
So that's the distinction he's talking about. Not a sort of a true annihilation of any sense of sort of ego-centered existence, but you're talking about something much more practical, it sounds like, sort of a way of being.
Well, I am talking about that way of being, but I am talking about when you get into this thing of meditating on the emptiness of inherent existence, it does involve totally changing our concept of I. Because right now our concept of I is really rather detrimental. Okay, I call it the tyranny of I. Okay? Because you combine our self-grasping ignorance and our self-centered thought together, and you get the tyranny of I. You know, always focus, me, I, my, and mine. How can I succeed? How can I be good? How can I get this? Somebody else is better than me. They do this better than me. I'm less than them. No wonder nobody loves me, and my life's falling apart. And how about, you know, we all have this incredible inner dialogue going on. It's like totally stupid. Yeah? Yeah? And so, you know, when we get rid of that self-grasping like that, then there's much more relaxation around the idea of self. Yeah, the self doesn't become such a big deal in this ego-centered way, which allows us to be much more efficacious in our actions to be a benefit.
So it's still there, it's just not the center of attention. But it's
In Buddhism, when we're talking about emptiness, we are not destroying something that exists. Selflessness does not mean destroying the self. It means realizing that there was no solid self to start with. Okay? Okay. It's like, you know, let's say we're here in this room and we're panicked because we think there's an elephant in this room. We're hallucinating an elephant. And we're totally panicked because there's an elephant in the room. I'm scared and this and that and the other thing. What you have to do is realize there's no elephant. There never has been. Okay? So in the same way, and at that point you see what was getting you in trouble was not that there was an elephant in the room, but that you had the idea there was an elephant when there wasn't one. But that's what was causing the suffering. So in the same way, how we think of I, okay, especially when we have one of these strong emotions from resentment and anger and I'm going to be tough, you know, that one has never existed. But because we think it exists, we drive ourselves nutty, you know, struggling for happiness for this thing that doesn't even exist, that we're totally convinced exists. Okay? So it's like somebody in this room, you know, worrying because they don't have the proper nail polish for the elephant, you know? But there's no elephant. So don't worry about the nail polish. Okay? Hold on. Yeah?
In your anecdote about the Dalai Lama being one of the panel experts in, I don't know, yes, I suggest a lot of humbleness, but isn't his response to suggesting, what do you think, kind of a subtle correction in the whole dialogue though, about the manner of what's being discussed?
So you're saying that when His Holiness threw it back on those people and said, what do you think?
Yes.
That maybe he's correcting what he perceived to be them seeing him as too much of an expert? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, okay, perhaps doing an American Idol, him being a surgeon, he's a heart surgeon. He needs all these tools to perform that operation, but these men are talking about foot surgery. He really doesn't know too much about foot surgery, but he knows the tools to do surgery. And they're talking about doing surgery on a foot, but, you know, they're talking about using an axe or, you know, a sledgehammer or something. He's confused, but maybe they have some type of point to make. What do you think? Mm-hmm. What's going on here?
I have no idea what was going on in His Holiness's mind. I can't speak for him. Yeah. answer that.
Can we get back to this question?
Yes.
How do you get rid of the I? I mean, don't tell me about the elephant, because that blows me away. You know, we're I.
Yeah.
Well, how do you get rid of it?
You don't get rid. You know, there is a conventional I. We label I on this, the combination of this body and mind, and dependence on this body and mind. But what's causing the problem is that we're grasping at this I as being something more than a convenient label. We're grasping it as there is a real me inside there, who just happens to be the center of the universe. Yeah? Yeah. And this I is the most precious thing. What we're trying to get rid of is the mind that is grasping at this false idea of I. Okay? That false I has never existed. There is a conventional I. You know, you say, I did this and I did that. It's a shortcut, so you don't have to say every time, this mind that is conjoined with this body walked down the street. You know, you say, I walked down the street. That's fine. Yeah, no problem with that. But where we run into problems is, I want this. Okay, look at the difference in the feeling of I when you say, I walked down the street, and I walk down the street. Okay.
So the quieter I is okay.
Yeah.
You spoke really about making things that we don't give as choices, and the deliberate choices. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if what we're talking about with reference to the self and meditations of emptiness, mm-hmm. you know, when we're making so many choices, is that how we would develop the wisdom to correctly guide those choices? Or what practices should we use so that we can, I guess, more appropriately view those choices that we have in our daily lives, you know, that are sometimes very complicated? How do we accurately view those? What practices should we develop?
So are you asking kind of what criteria do we use to make good choices in our life?
Not necessarily what criteria, but what practices
Okay. So what attributes or qualities within ourselves do we want to develop so that we can make better choices in our life? Okay. So I think one attribute is the ability to slow down and be aware of what our body's doing, what our mouth is saying, and especially what's going on in our mind. Okay, so just that ability to become more aware of our body, speech, and mind, not in a paranoid way of what am I doing, but just in a way of, okay, what kind of energy do I have, and what am I thinking about? Because what I'm thinking about is creating the causes for what I'm going to become, and I care about that. So this ability to be more aware, okay, to gain that, you need to slow down, okay. To be able to slow down, you need to cut out some of the useless things that you do in your life, okay. And to do that, then we need to, you know, I mean, it's all, you have to do a lot of things all at one time. There's not like a first beginning point. But I think starting to slow down, looking at the choices that we're making, I think another quality that's very important is having high regard for ethical conduct. Because if we have high regard for ethical conduct, then that will inform our choices, because then when we have a choice to make, we won't be looking at it from how can I get the best for myself. We're going to be looking at it from how can I keep my ethical conduct in a way that I'm not going to be harming other sentient beings.
So the ethical conduct, that's the criteria?
I think that's one criteria, yeah. It's one criteria I use when I make decisions. is what situation will I be able to keep better ethical conduct in? Because I know that if I get myself into a situation where my mind is not going to be strong enough to keep good ethical conduct, I'm a goner. You know? As soon as we don't keep good ethical conduct, our life becomes a mess. Yeah, very quickly. Very quickly. Yeah? So I think that's something that's really important. It's one of the criteria. Similarly, I think having a high regard for bodhicitta is something that helps us, because then bodhicitta can help us. It can be a criteria for making decisions. In other words, what situation will be most conducive for my developing bodhicitta? Or in what situation can I be the most useful to others in the long being? You know, either one of those, you know, having to do with bodhicitta. Yeah. I think that helps us make decisions. Sometimes the basic meditation that we do that we want to do so that we even see this as something important to think about is a meditation on impermanence and death. Okay? Because if we think about impermanence and death, then we realize, hey, you know, my life is in the process of ending. I don't know when it's going to end. Yeah, how am I going to feel about my life when it comes time to die? Okay. So instead of always just thinking about ourselves, who we are right now in this body, in this situation, project yourself ahead to the time when you die. And we don't know if that's going to be tonight or in another 60 years. We have no idea. But when I get to the end of my life and I look back on my life, what will I have felt good about doing and what will I have not felt good about doing? And if I'm doing things now that at the end of my life I'm not going to feel good about having done, I need to stop doing those things. You know? And if at the end of my life there's things that I know that I want to feel good about having done in my life, then I need to start doing those things now. Even if I can't do them wonderfully perfectly, I need to start going in that direction. Yeah?
I wondered if you would lead us in this one-minute long life prayer.
Sure. Do you have the long version or the short version?
Four lines, and you had it tuned to a translation.
Oh, yes.
It's different than our translation, so if you could just maybe teach it to us.
Okay. Okay, so the one I do. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. That's the one we do. Okay, so in the snowy mountain paradise, which the Tibetans think is Tibet, but actually it's Shirasti Abbey. So in the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Happiness, okay. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso, that's His Holiness's ordination name, Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara. Okay. Shall we try? In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. I think it's good if we also make strong dedication prayers in this life and future lives to always have Dharma contact with His Holiness, to be able to study and practice under His guidance, to this life and future lives, when we receive teachings, to have an open mind and take in the teachings with a positive aspiration to practice. And let's dedicate also so that we may develop the love and compassion and patience and forgiveness similar to His Holiness's, so that in our life, you know, whatever situation we find ourselves in, our mind can be free of the tyranny of I and imbued with that mind of kindness that looks out for the welfare and benefit of all sentient beings. And so let's also dedicate so that through the positive potential we created, that we may all quickly become Buddhas, that all the beings on this planet, in this universe, in all universes, can meet the Dharma, can develop quiet, peaceful minds, and think about caring for each other.